in which order, which priority, how much they get paid, things like that. And then there's also a willfulness section, and the willfulness is what did they know and when did they know it. So on the question about will the company's board of directors be considered liable, that's asking will the company's board of directors all be considered responsible persons, and the answer is not necessarily. It depends on who had what authority, and that's determined under the 4180 interview. And then the question is, what about members who have since left the board? Well, the period that the taxes are unpaid is what the revenue officer is going to focus on. So if somebody was on the board of directors or was a responsible person during the time that the payroll taxes were unpaid, then even if they've left the company, they can still be liable. Now, the thing that bothers me about this question is that it says that payroll taxes haven't been prepared or paid. And the thing is, what they really want to do is work out some kind of payment plan, installment agreement, to get current and to pay the delinquent payroll taxes. But the IRS won't even consider an installment agreement if the corporation isn't in compliance. So what they need to do first is prepare all delinquent returns. And then secondly is start making federal tax deposits. And the first quarter 2017 return is for January, February, March, and it's due April 30th. So you'd probably, if you could, you would want to full pay that return for the first quarter of 17 so that you're in current compliance and you want to stay in compliance from now forward. If the first quarter of 2017 is impossible because half the quarter has passed and there's just no way you can catch up, then I would include the first quarter of 17 in whatever agreement that you have. But starting April 1st, I would make sure that all federal tax deposits are timely made.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. And Jimmy, thank you very much for submitting that question. A lot of information there when it comes to payroll taxes and the responsible persons. Next question is also from a subscriber. His name is Howard. He's a CPA. He's asking, will the IRS accept an offering compromise for liabilities stemming from payroll taxes? If so, is it the same criteria for an individual? Please elaborate.
So I'm not sure if the taxpayer is a corporation or a sole proprietorship, but the answer is yes, there is something called an in-business OIC, and it is possible, but again, the corporation or the sole proprietorship needs to be in current compliance. And basically, it's the same criteria whether it's an individual or not, but they're really looking at going forward and just making sure that the company or the individual stays in compliance. And usually, payroll tax issues are assigned to a revenue officer. So it seems like it'd be something that you would want to discuss with the revenue officer and see what they're willing to do. But yes, it is possible.
And what about the criteria, Norman? Is that similar to the individual?
It is. It's based on ability to pay, and it's based on current and future compliance.
Got it. Thank you very much, Howard, for that question. Moving on to Angela, who is an attorney and also a subscriber. She's asking, Will the IRS ever allow expenses over the local and national standards for an installment agreement request? I have a client who has relatives living with them, but they are not dependents, although she provides for them.
So the answer is yes, but it needs to be highly documented. So if there's a reason why the taxpayer expenses are above the local and national standards, then they would need either proof and a good explanation. So, for instance, on food, if the taxpayer had a note from a doctor saying that they're on some kind of special diet and the diet is expensive and so their food costs are above the national standards, then if you have the doctor's note and receipts showing the expenses, those expenses should be allowed. As to relatives living with them, but they're not dependents, that may be possible, but I'd have to know more about it, like who they are and what their situation is. And but the short answer is yes, local and national standards aren't written in stone, but there are extra hoops that you need to jump through in order to get expenses above the standards allowed. The other thing to consider is the one-year rule. And the one-year rule says that even if the taxpayer has expenses that are beyond the standards, that the IRS will give the taxpayer a year to get those expenses in line with the standards. And so an installment agreement would be set up where it would be a certain amount for a year, and then after a year, it would go up to the only allowing the national standards for expenses. So that's something that the IRS doesn't advertise and don't really tell you, and you need to know about it. But it's called the one-year rule. So, for instance, if a taxpayer was renting and the rent was above standard, well, they're not expecting the taxpayer to move out of their apartment immediately. So they give them a year, or depending when the lease is up, because they're not going to ask the taxpayer to break their lease. So when the lease is up, then they need to move to a more affordable place. But the answer is, yes, the IRS will allow expenses above the standards, but they need to be well documented.
And as a reminder, that applies to installment agreements, because it's a little different story for offers, right, Norman?
Well, this is an installment agreement.
Right, just confirming it's an installment agreement.
Right, an offer is different. An offer is strictly by its standards.
Got it. All right, thank you, Angela, for that question. Now, moving on to Peter. Peter's a CPA, and he's asking, if a taxpayer has been assessed tax for 2014, but is now unemployed and considering filing for personal bankruptcy, will the taxpayer's tax debts be released in a personal bankruptcy?
Well, there's not much information, but just looking at this, I'd have to say no. And the reason is that 2014 tax return was due either April or October of 2015. And the three-year rule, which is that taxes are not dischargeable unless it's more than 3 years from the due date of the return, that they would have to wait at least until April 16 or 17 or 18, depending on what day the tax return was due for 2014. But that would have been sometime in 2015, so 3 years would be 2018. So you couldn't file bankruptcy before middle of April 2018 and discharge 2014 tax debt.
Got it. Again, as a reminder, there are different bankruptcy rules when it comes to filing and or discharging those taxes, so we got to look into those closer. Moving on to Matt, is an EA, and he's asking, it looks like several questions here. Is there a maximum penalty amount that can be abated under the first-time penalty abatement program? And can the first-time penalty abatement program be applied both to individuals and businesses? And lastly, how difficult is it to deal with the IRS on the first-time penalty abatement program?
Okay, so the first question about maximum penalty amount that can be abated, no, there's not a limit. If you qualify for the first-time abatement program, then you qualify and the penalty will be abated regardless of the amount. The second question is, it can be applied to both individuals and businesses? And again, the answer is yes, it can. And then the question is, how difficult is it to deal with the IRS on the first-time penalty abatement program? And the answer is, could be very difficult. And the reason is that they have a software program, and they ask questions, and you answer them. And at the end of the questions, they tell you whether or not the taxpayer qualifies for the program. And the way that the software is set up, it almost always says no. And I've told this story before where I was dealing with a rep and went through the questions, and at the end they said no. And I said, well, just for fun, let's do it again. And we went through the same questions, and I answered them all differently. So wherever I said no, I said yes, and wherever I said yes, I said no. And it still came out no. And then I tried it the third time, and it came out no. But I've read reports, and supposedly they've fixed that problem, and it's easier now. But it isn't a slam dunk. And remember, whoever you're dealing with on the other end of the phone may or may not be well qualified, may or may not know all the nuances of the program, and may or may not be applying the software program correctly. But it's definitely worth a chance. It's always worth it to try. And if it's denied, you always have appeal rights, which you want to preserve. So, yeah, I would go for it.
Now, for those who don't have a lot of experience in a first-time penalty abatement program, Norman, can you explain, for instance, if it's 3 years of failure to file penalties, does the program qualify all 3 years?
Or no, only the earliest year. So, right, so first-time penalty abatement doesn't mean that they've audited you or assessed a bunch of penalties for several years all at one time, and that you could abate all the years. It's just the earliest year. And that would be difficult because you need to be in current compliance. So they look at since the penalty, have you been in compliance, and were you in compliance prior to the penalty? So it's really for somebody who something happened and just got a penalty one time and otherwise has a clean record. It's not for somebody who habitually gets penalties.
Got it. I want to make sure we clarified that. All right, moving on. Thank you, Matt, for that question. Moving on to Barbara, who is a CPA. Her question is, I have a client who just got a notice from the EDD. He is being audited for classifying employees as independent contractors. According to him, he received W-9s from everybody and issued 1099s as required. Why would the EDD still be going after him, and how do we fight this?
Okay, so EDD is a California taxing agency. It's the Employment Development Department, and it has to do with payroll taxes and unemployment. And the thing is, there's like 10 or 12 criteria that the EDD uses to determine whether somebody is an individual, is an independent contractor, or an employee. And one of those criteria is the W-9s and the 1099s, but there's lots of other ones too. And so the fact that the independent contractor, we'll call them, received W-9s, and they were issued 1099s, doesn't automatically make them an independent contractor. Even, I'll go one step further, even having an independent contractor agreement between the company and the individual doesn't necessarily make them an independent contractor. And so there are a lot of criteria that they look at, and what they do then is they balance the entire picture on a case-by-case matter, and they determine it based on weighing the different factors. What could be helpful is the ADD issues what's called information sheets, and they do it by industry. So depending on what industry we're talking about, is it a janitorial service? Is it truck drivers? Is it cab drivers? What it is, look up on the ADD website and download their information sheet for that industry, and we'll give explanation of the factors that they're looking at. And also, you want to look at the case law, because there have been other cases that from the same industry, and they'll help determine what other factors and how they're weighted, and that could help determine. But I had a case where the company went to the ADD before they started the business and said, we're going to be selling T-shirts, and we're going to have these, we're going to buy T-shirts from these individuals who are going to make them pursuant to our specification, but they're going to be buying the blank T-shirts and buying the equipment and silk screening them. Are these independent contractors or employees? And the ADD told them, sounds like independent contractors to us. So based on the ADD's recommendation, they started the business and then later were audited, and they were determined that they were employees, and went back to the ADD and said, but when I explained everything to you, you said they were independent contractors. And the ADD said, did we put that in writing? So if you're going to ask the ADD to clarify something, have them put it in writing. Ended up with, we did prevail at the end, but the ADD just telling you unofficially not to worry that it's their independent contractors isn't going to protect you. So get whatever you're going to get from them in writing and hope for the best.
All right. Thank you, Norman. And Barbara, hopefully that answers your question. And, yeah, you know, we are covering a lot of different topics here, going back from IRS, in this case, EDD issues. And we're trying to do our best to keep it in line to make sure that everyone attending understands what's going on. But I'm sure as you listen to the answers, you will have additional questions. So for this, we recommend taking some of our courses online. You can visit us on our website to check out a list of our complete courses. We go from the very beginning to intermediate to advanced, installment agreements, offers and compromise, audits and appeals. There's a whole slew of different courses available to everyone. As an added bonus for everyone that's attending today's forum, we are offering a 30% off coupon for everything on our website. So please take advantage of that. Take a look at the courses. Take a look at our materials, because we also have textbooks and supplementary books and manuals to help you be successful in practicing tax resolution. I will be pushing some of this information right now in our chat box. So take a look at that. And as a reminder, I always do a follow-up email with the promotions that we offer during the call. Okay, so moving on to the next question. This is from Derek, who's a CPA. Says, I'm a CPA and just getting started in tax resolution. How often do I need to obtain a Covell letter, and what circumstances will they come into play?
Okay, so I'm a tax attorney and a bankruptcy attorney. And as an attorney, I can rely on the attorney-client privilege or confidentiality to protect communication between myself and my client. The problem is that accountants normally don't have the same privilege or confidentiality that lawyers do. So to get around this, what happens is I would hire an accountant to consult me on particular tax issues. So rather than the client hiring the accountant, the attorney hires the accountant, and the accountant then reports to me as the attorney, and in that way, that communication is privileged. I mean, attorneys routinely hire outside accountants or private investigators or other consultants, and there's an attorney-client privilege between that private investigator or accountant or consultant and the attorney, where there wouldn't be between, let's say, a private investigator or an accountant and the client. So the lawyer engages the accountant to be part of the legal team, and part of that engagement is this Covell letter, and Covell is named after there was an IRS agent, and after he retired from the IRS, he was an accountant in a tax law firm, and he worked with the tax attorney on a case and was subpoenaed by the government to testify about certain matters on the case, and he invoked the attorney-client privilege because he said even though he wasn't an attorney, he worked for the attorney just like a paralegal or somebody else in the attorney's office, and therefore that it was subject to attorney-client privilege and prevailed. That was like 1961, so it's been over 50 years, and it's changed a bit. It's been narrowed. It's been eliminated, for instance, on criminal cases, and so it has some limited effect. But the important thing to know is that the only way to bring an accountant under the cloak of the attorney-client privilege is through this Covell agreement. Second, it's really important that the attorney engages the accountant, not the client. So this ensures that the accountant is working for the lawyer and not for the client. And third, it's really important that it's a new accountant rather than the client's existing accountant that you hire. And that's oftentimes a rubbing point because the client can think of a million reasons why it wants to stick with their old accountant. But the problem is that any communication between the accountant and the lawyer would be for only communications that preceded the Covell letter, so that any communications between the accountant and the client prior to the tax attorney getting involved wouldn't be protected. And so it would really have very limited use. So that's why, in order to really do it correctly, the lawyer would want to hire a new accountant and not the client's existing accountant. So it's best for the lawyer to always hire an independent, fresh accountant to represent him rather than the client's old accountant. So I'm not sure what matters you're working on or why you think you would need the Covell letter, but the Covell letter would be if the client went to a tax attorney first, and then the tax attorney hired the accountant. That's how it works. Not the other way around. Not the client going to the accountant and then the accountant hiring an attorney. That wouldn't work. So it's kind of limited scenario, and I'm not sure why, but I don't think you would need it except something like an internal audit or something where you'd want to protect what you discover in the audit.
All right, Derek, I hope that answers your question. And as a reminder, anyone on the forum needs additional clarification or wants us to dive in a little further into their particular case, take a look at our subscription programs, because that does allow consultation time so we can spend as much time or as little time as you want us to on a particular case to help you get through it. Again, the subscription service allows you to do that with the consultation time. Okay, moving on to Jody, who's a CPA. Jody emailed us a question, and I see, Jody, that you also just submitted, looks like a follow-up question in our chat box. So I want to make sure that we get to you, and hopefully Norman will answer the bulk of your question with what you submitted online. So I did paraphrase this because, Jody, you provided a lot of information and detail, so I paraphrased this to kind of keep it short. So Jody said, new client owes $98,000 with $28,000 in penalties, has filed all delinquent returns as of 2013, previous firm submitted an offer in compromise that was denied due to the ability to pay, client filed bankruptcy but taxes were too new to be discharged, no assets, and income is just under $100,000. Not sure what to do with this case. Should I try another offer in compromise or penalty abatement? Do I need to file Form 843, or is a letter enough? Your guidance is appreciated, Jody says.
Well, okay, so there's a lot of options. Form 843 is the claim for refund and request for abatement. So that would eliminate possibly all or some of the penalties, because I don't know how many years that $28,000 in penalties is for, and I don't know what the penalty is for, because remember, not all penalties can be abated. We're looking at failure to file and failure to pay penalties normally. So I'm not sure what the penalties are for. Also, I'm not sure if the $98,000 includes the penalties or it's $98,000 in tax and $28,000 in penalties. Also, I'm not sure if there was if the previous offer was rejected for ability to pay, I'm not sure if there's any change in circumstance. The offer would look at two things. One would be the value of the assets. So I don't know if the taxpayer assets have diminished, which would justify a lower offer. Or the second part of an offer is based on disposable income. So I don't know if their income has gone down and therefore there's less disposable income, and that too would justify a lower offer. I guess if you were going to do it in some kind of order, I would do the penalty abatement first, just to see if that's successful or not. And yeah, you could use the Form 843, but again, I'm not sure if you're going to be using the first-time penalty abatement program to abate the penalties, or if you're requesting that the penalties be abated under reasonable cause, and you need to look up reasonable cause, because it's kind of a narrow exception on reasonable causes usually justified reliance on a tax professional. So, for instance, if the taxpayer's accountant told them that they didn't need to file a return. And they did. That the client could have justifiably relied on the accountant's recommendation that a return wasn't required. However, for instance, a due date of a return is not something that a taxpayer can reasonably rely on the professional. What the IRS case law says is that the due date of a return is easy enough to determine that a taxpayer can determine it themselves, and they don't need to rely on a professional to tell them when their tax return is due. So you could apply for the penalty abatement, see if that's granted or not. And if there's some change in circumstance, if since the last offer in terms of either value of the assets or the amount of disposable income, you may want to submit another offer. That's about all I can say at this time.
Thank you, Norman. Yes, Jody, so pay attention to the changes in circumstances and do the numbers and see what the monthly disposable income shows. I know you've indicated there are no assets, but there are other factors to consider. Okay, moving on to Jared. Jared is an attorney, and Jared is asking, if the IRS issues a substitute for return and the taxpayer thereafter files a tax return, from what date does the collection statute of limitations begin to run? The date of the SFR or the date the taxpayer files a return?
So actually, it's 10 years. The statute on collection, it's called the CSED, C-S-E-D, it's collection statute expiration date, and it's 10 years from the date of assessment. So in this scenario, it wouldn't be 10 years from the date the taxpayer files a return. It would be 10 years from the date that the IRS assesses the tax based on the return. And it would be the later date. And even that's also true with audits, audit assessments. If a taxpayer files a return and he owes $10,000, and then 2 years later the IRS does an audit and assesses an additional $1,000, that audit, all the taxes then is discharged or no longer collectible 10 years from the date of the assessment of based on the audit, not the return. So it's always the later date, 10 years from that later date, even though you would think that it would be split up and that some tax would be just uncollectible 10 years from the date it was assessed and then 10 years from the audit assessment, but it's all rolled into one. There's only one statute date, and that's the later date. So it would be 10 years from the date that the return is assessed.
Thank you, Norman, and thank you, Jared, for that question. Moving on to Frank. Frank is an enrolled agent, and he says, I have submitted an offer in compromise last month and waiting for the IRS to confirm receipt / acceptance of the offer. How long will this take, and will it toll the statute while being reviewed?
So normally you can expect to get a letter from the IRS, I would say within 6 months of submitting the offer, and the letter would say, as we received your offer, and it's going to be assigned to an offer specialist, and we'll get back to you in 90 days or whatever. The first hurdle is for the offer department to determine whether or not the offer is processable. So if everything is correctly filled out and all the fees have been paid, etc., then the offer is processable. It can go forward. If there's some problem with the paperwork and it's not processable, then it's returned right away. So say 6 months till you hear something, and then maybe another 90 days until it gets assigned to an offer specialist. Or after 90 days, you may get another letter that says, we need another 90 days. So now we're talking about a year, and the IRS has 2 years to work an offer. And if after 2 years the offer hasn't been accepted or rejected, it's considered accepted. But what happens usually is you don't hear anything for a year or a year and a half, and then all of a sudden they want update, or they want some missing information or whatever right away. I've never had an offer get accepted because of the two-year rule, but I've had a lot of offers extend to pretty close to the deadline. Oh, and the other question about does it toll the statute? Yes, because a good faith offer tolls collection, and so anytime collection is tolled, the collection statute is tolled. So plus 30 days, because if the offer is rejected, then you have 30 days to appeal it. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah, be patient. It takes a while, and it does toll the statute, but it also tolls collection. So that's the good thing.
All right, Norman. Thank you very much, Frank, for that question. Let me just take a quick minute, because a lot of you do ask when our next events are coming up. Peter Steffen, the founder of the Tax Resolution Institute, does have an event, a live event, coming up on March 31st. He's been asked to speak there, part of Business Fundamental Bootcamp. This bootcamp features speakers and panelists who provide expert advice for CEOs and CXOs of early and growth stage companies. So he's been asked to talk about the subject on taxes, including resolution. If you wish to attend, it's going to be here in Los Angeles at the Skirball Center. I will push a link for more information, and there is a promotion for 50% off for members that are going to be attending through our portal. So I will push that link for you. Just letting you know what upcoming event is Peter's going to be speaking at. So moving on to the next question. This is from Joseph, who is an EA. He says, I have a client who is retired and lives abroad. They owe back taxes from when they were still working and earning money in California. If we want to submit an offer in compromise, what standards do we use?
We had a similar problem once, and that was we had a client living in Spain, and their expenses were way off the chart, and the IRS stuck with national standards. So you might be able to convince them otherwise. And I'm not sure if they're living someplace that's cheaper or more expensive than the United States. So I don't know if it would work for or against the taxpayer. But to answer your question is, because the IRS doesn't have the experience on what standard expenses would be in other countries, they have to go by national standards. And also, you need to, when filling out like a 433 AOIC, you need to convert everything to dollars, because they won't convert euros or whatever you're dealing with. So everything needs to be in dollars. And I would try to use national standards to avoid confusion.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to the next question is Erica. She's a CPA. Have you used the online streamlined installment agreement request form with the IRS? I just tried it for one of my clients, and it did not accept the payment I requested. I took their liability of $12,000 and divided it by 72 months, and proposed $170. The system rejected it and said the minimum acceptable was $520. Why would that be?
Okay, my guess is that there's a CSET issue, and that is that in order to qualify for a streamlined installment agreement, the the tax has to be fully paid within either 72 months or by the collection statute expiration date, whichever occurs first. So if they owe taxes for, you know, years that are approaching the collection statute, then their computer would calculate it based on how many months are left on the collection statute, and that's how they would come up with some number like $520 a month, even though it's only $12,000. That's because the collection statute expires prior to the 72 months.
That makes sense. So, Erica, if your client's not able to afford the 520, then you have to go the long way. It's no longer a streamlined installment agreement. Okay, so moving on to George. He's a CPA.
Oh, can I just add? How that would work is you would complete a 433F, and rather than a streamlined, you would ask for what's called a partial pay installment agreement, which would be that they would collect whatever the taxpayer could afford based on their 433F until the statute reaches the collection cutoff date. And then after that, that year's tax is no longer collectible. And so they would collect what they could until the statute expires, and then the rest is forgiven.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Norma, for that. So George is a CPA and is asking, can you explain how we can use an offering compromise doubtless to liability versus an audit reconsideration? I've heard Peter in previous courses go into detail about this, but I missed something.
So an OIC doubt as to liability, I mean, is in a sense an audit reconsideration, because either you have documents that weren't provided to the auditor for whatever reason, or you have some calculation that brings the liability down below the liability that was established at the audit. But remember, an OIC doubt is a liability. The offer has to submit an amount equal to the amount that the taxpayer claims that they owe. So you can't submit an offer doubt as a liability, which is a 656L, as opposed to just a 656 in the offer. You have to offer something. So it can't be that I don't owe anything. You have to say, well, instead of owing the $10,000 that the auditor says, I really only owe one. Where in an audit reconsideration, you could claim that you owe nothing, that you couldn't do in the offer, but the offer doesn't have a deadline, where the audit reconsideration might. So, like for instance, when the notice of deficiency is issued, it's called a 90-day letter, and the taxpayer has 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court. Well, that petition in U.S. tax court is basically an audit reconsideration, because it's going to be assigned to an IRS attorney, area counsel, but usually they're going to assign it either to an auditor or to a settlement officer, and you'll get another chance, basically another bite of the apple on the audit. And if you really do owe nothing, you can walk away from tax court with usually what happens is it's not going to go to trial. You're going to enter into a stipulated decision, and the stipulated decision will say that you owe nothing or whatever amount you agree to, and it will be signed off by the taxpayers council of the taxpayer if they're in pro per, and the IRS counsel, and then the judge signs it, and it's entered, and it becomes an order. But if a client comes to us, and it's past the 90 days, and they've lost the right to petition the tax court, then really an offer, doubtless a liability, is the only solution. So some of it, a lot of it has to do with timing.
That's right. All right, Norman, thank you very much. George, hopefully that answers your question. Last question here from people who submitted online is from Stan. He's an attorney. He says, I helped a friend of mine submit an offer in compromise for a large liability, and it got denied based on the IRS claiming he could full pay the liability. I believe they are basing their decision on information on his 2015 tax return. His situation has changed dramatically, and we feel he is a good candidate. Can you explain the appeals process for this type of case?
So when the IRS sends out a letter saying that the offer's been denied and that the taxpayer has the ability to full pay, you have 30 days to appeal it. So hopefully, if you're within the appeal period, I would say that I would include a copy of the taxpayer's 2016 tax return and show that their ability to pay has been greatly reduced since 2015. And I would use the 2016 return to make my point. If the appeals period has expired, then you would have to file and submit a whole new offer. And use information, current information, including the 2016 return.
Right, and Norman, you bring up a very interesting point because this time of year is crucial for 2016 to determine whether or not a taxpayer will owe. So regardless if you're doing an offer, an installment agreement, 2016 plays a big role because not only does it show income information that might be pertinent to what you're trying to do, but also if you have liability that you want to add, you want to get that filed right away.
Right, even though the tax return's not due until April 15 or 16 or 17, the IRS has been accepting 2016 returns since January 23rd. So if you're going to be submitting an offer or an installment agreement request, you really want 2016 return prepared in advance, because if you're going to owe for 2016 and you haven't included it in part of the offer or part of the installment agreement, it's going to default. And secondly, is the information is more current, and especially if 2016 is less than 2015, you want to use the lower amount to get a lower offer or a lower installment agreement.
That's right. Okay, so now we're going to go ahead and open it up for callers to go ahead and ask some additional questions. We do have about a little over 5 minutes to go. So some people have been submitting their questions through the chat box or through the questions box, so I'm going to go ahead and start going through those. And if time permitting, we will open it up to the phone line for additional ones. So, Jody, I believe we answered your question regarding the penalty abatement. You now clarify saying that the call was about a penalty abatement for 2002, and you were told that you had to submit in writing because the year was archived. Is this just writing a letter, or is there a form? So I believe Norman went over the form with you.
Yeah, I would complete the form 843.
Got it. Okay, so thank you, Jody, for that. Moving on to Pyosha has a question also regarding the first-time penalty abatement. Pyosha says, for the first-time penalty abatement program, can a taxpayer that has had an arrangement for 3 years, I'm assuming an installment agreement, and has been paying on time, be eligible for the abatement?
Yes.
So the question is yes, and I believe Ayosha, Norman did go into detail when answering one of the other questions. So thank you for that. Moving on to Mark. Mark indicates that he's an EA. He has a client that originally filed their 2007 taxes on May 28, 2008. $300 levy January in 2009. Lien filed also in 2009. Account deemed currently non-collectible in 2010. Amendment on April 2012. He still owes $12,000, including interest. What date does this debt disappear? Does the lien disappear at the same time?
So the lien is what's called a self-releasing lien, in the sense that unless the IRS renews it within, I think, 31 days after it's scheduled to expire, it can get renewed, but it's 10 years from the date of assessment, not 10 years from the date that the lien was filed or recorded. So usually the lien self-releases the same time that the tax becomes uncollectible. But the IRS can still renew the lien if it does so timely for another 10 years, but that's not active collection, that's passive collection, in the sense that they're not going to levy your bank account or your wages. But if the lien attaches, let's say, to your home, and even though the taxes become non-collectible against a person that's called in personam jurisdiction, the IRS still retains what's called in rem jurisdiction, which is jurisdiction against the property. And so if you refinanced or sold property and the IRS had renewed their lien, then they could get paid from the proceeds of the sale of the house or the refinance.
Right. And Mark, you also ask about when the CSED date is, in other terms, but you had a lot of tolling events here. So the transcripts need to review and analyze, and I don't think we're going to be able to answer that question specifically today, just because you do list a couple tolling events, and the calculation needs to be done accurately to be able to give you that CSED date.
Yeah, there's lots of events that could toll the collection statute, bankruptcy, appeals, living outside the United States for greater than 6 months. So you would have to analyze all those tolling events and determine when the statute would expire. Also, the time between submitting an installment agreement request and having that installment agreement accepted, that also tolls collection, so that also tolls the statute. So the thing to remember is that there's lots of events that can toll the collection statute, and the place to begin to determine that would be ordering the account transcripts.
Yeah, thank you very much, Norman, for clarifying that. Okay, moving on to the next question is from John. John says he has a new attorney client who has not filed in 6 years. He got Bell's palsy and is not able to work. His sister is his sole means of support. Do I file the unfiled returns and then go for doubt as to collectability? Or he may be able to earn some income this year, maybe $5,000. Do I wait, have them earn the income, and then file an offer and compromise to get rid of the IRS debt?
Well, first thing is to file the delinquent returns. And then wait till they get assessed. And then what's the question about whether to submit an offer?
Right. He's got income coming in for this year. He wants to know whether he should wait till the income is earned or do it now.
I would do it now. So I would do it all at the same time, including 2016. Right. And even if some of those years doesn't require returns. If there was no income, for instance, I would still file zero return, so that at least the returns have been filed, even if there's no income for that year.
Right. The good thing to remember is you have to be in compliance to submit an offer. So that's what Norman's speaking about. And then he also mentioned the income is $5,000, so I think it's inconsequential.
I mean, on any national standard, there'll be no disposable income.
Right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there's several other questions that we're not going to be able to get to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bank these for next call. As a reminder, the next call is April 4th. I thank you all for attending this month's Tax Tuesdays Practitioners Forum. We hope you got some valuable information. As a reminder, visit our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org. Check out our courses list. Take advantage of that 30% discount that I pushed in the link. Again, I will follow this up with an email giving you the information once again. But we will see you next month. And please don't forget to submit your questions earlier next time so we can get to all of them. Thank you all. Talk to you soon.